enough water, just enough wine, just enough crumbs, a dollar and a dime, just enough hope to keep us toeing the line. But sooner or later,
that song is Sooner or Later by Eliza Gilkinson. We use it as the introduction to Activist Radio, where we offer history we're pretty sure you didn't learn in high school. We have a couple of news stories you won't find in the New York Times, and we have a couple of musical selections to help you join the resistance. Activist Radio can be heard Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KBOO, and they're at 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. Thursdays 11 to 12 noon on WRFA, and that's 107.9 FM in Jamestown, New York. Thursdays 5 to 6 p.m. on WVKR, 91.3 FM at Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York. Thursdays 7 to 8 p.m. on WBDY, and they're at 99.5 FM at the Bundy in Binghamton, New York. Fridays 4 to 5 p.m. on WEFR, that's 1700 AM in Fairmont, West Virginia. Sundays 1:30 to 2:30 p.m. on WESU, and they're at 88.1 FM at Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut. Sundays 4 to 5 p.m. from WIOF, and they're at 104.1 FM in Woodstock, New York. Sundays 5 to 6 p.m. for the Progressive Radio Network. Find them at prn.live. That's prn.live. And finally, Mondays 11 to 12 noon on WCAA, and they're at 107.3 FM in Albany, New York. Past programs are available as a podcast. Just search on Activist Radio or go to classwars.org at any time and listen to our last 10 programs. Our guest today is going to be Robert Roth. He's a co-founder of the Haiti Action Committee and part of Central American Solidarity Movement in the 1980s and 1990s as well. And we talk today about Haiti, its history, and its long-term repression by the United States, which brings us the views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, its board of directors, or its constituents. Just the views of me today, Fred, bringing you up to date on America's hidden class wars.
Be louder than your screams. The people's day will come. Emma Goldman, I sang this song for you. Big Bill Haywood and Mother Jones too. Psycho and Vanzetti, they took your lives. But we can organize.
And that's The People's Day by Otis Gibbs. We use it as the introduction to the first part of Activist Radio. We call it History You Didn't Learn in High School. It's an important part of Activist Radio. We try to remember the history of social struggle, what worked, what didn't work. All of it often left out of our corporate media, which doesn't want us to do anything but vote every 4 years in various elections. So the history of social struggle is an evaluation of the possibilities of rising up in the streets and changing our corrupt system. All right, we're going to go in history to September 5th, 1882. Well over 10,000 workers demanding an 8-hour day marched to protest working conditions in the first ever U.S. Labor Day parade held in New York City. About 250,000 New Yorkers turned out to watch. The idea was that of Peter McGuire, a union carpenter, co-founder of the Federation of Organized Trades and Labor Unions, a precursor to the American Federation of Labor. The Knights of Labor were also involved in the march, and their inclusion of all workers lent an aura of radicalism to the day's events. The Knights were famous for organizing the unskilled as well as immigrant workers, which was a shock for a nation that had just passed the Chinese Exclusion Act to limit Asian workers. The Knights of Labor stood against the anti-immigration movement that was as strong then as it is today. In fact, McGuire and other leaders argued for an international celebration of labor, one that would mark a victory for workers all around the world. In May 1886, the famous Haymaker riots and bombing occurred in Chicago, which consolidated the movement as one that was worldwide. In an effort to divert attention from labor activism, President Grover Cleveland recognized a Labor Day celebration in September, just so that the Haymarket riots and May 1st would not be recognized. But May 1st was in fact selected by the 1889 Paris Second Internationale as Workers' Day, a holiday still celebrated by most countries in May 1st. Only the U.S. and Canada recognized the Labor Day in September. But September 5th has another piece of labor history associated with it. On that day in 1917, the largest roundup of so-called subversives took place in 48 raids across the country. Federal agents seized records, destroyed equipment, and took books, and arrested hundreds of activists who were members of the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, known fondly as the Wobblies. The IWW had taken a leadership role in the radical labor movement by organizing wildcat strikes and opposing an ongoing war, World War I. The IWW leader Big Bill Haywood was arrested and charged with, quote, crimes of labor, and the other charge was obstructing World War I. We see a new labor movement today, as this country's workers are struggling with high living costs and low wages. Their livelihoods have been jeopardized by free trade, which sends so many good-paying jobs overseas. Workers have every right to be angry. It's really the only way that labor has clawed anything back from the billionaire class, which has made Wall Street speculation the backbone of our economy. But labor activism is the last thing that our nation's billionaires really want. They want perpetual war, since that's the most profitable of industries. They also want full-spectrum domination of the labor force, which they've always seen as somehow subversive to their interests. And since we live in a corrupted society where big money buys Congress, anything is possible. If a majority of billionaires want a fascist, racist leader, why then, they will pay for a Republican victory. If a majority of billionaires want a government for the well-off, without the fascist trappings, they will probably get Harris and Walz. Nothing much has changed here. The wars go on, the Palestinian people will be slaughtered, and the genocide will be owned by those corrupt politicians, as well as by you and me, the very people who will end up paying for all those missiles and bombs in Gaza. To get a different society, we'll have to do more. We'll have to resist the billionaires and their bribed political class. We have to dismantle the corporations so they become less efficient at transferring money from the poorest to the very richest. And we have to prepare for the FBI and the national security state when it comes to lock people up for their free expression of ideas. Today it's the American People's Socialist Party. Tomorrow will be Democracy Now! And The Intercept. We're going to go to a song now. This is by The Kingsmen. The song is Louie, Louie. And I picked it because the FBI, back in the late 1960s, spent over 2 years investigating this song, trying to find some connection to obscenity. And after 2.5 years, they called it off. But I think the song sort of reminds us of FBI repression. It has its moments of absurdity going after this very popular song because somehow they were sure it was subversive and obscene. So here's to the FBI. Let's listen to Louie Louie. That's They Lied by Jay Mankita. It's lead into the next part of Activist Radio. It has its own website, fantasylandmedia.org, where you can take a look at the stories over the last decade and even keyword search them. So it's a good resource for determining the corporate-controlled lies where all the news is made by the people in charge. That's, of course, the corporations and your very own government. Well, our first story is from The Intercept. Quote, in early August, Columbia University told Congress that most of the students arrested in the past year for protesting against Israel's war in Gaza would be allowed to return to campus for the fall. Then a congressional inquiry applied pressure. Last week, the Republican chair of the House Committee on Education and Workforce, which has been conducting an inquiry into Columbia's handling of the protests since this spring, published a letter blasting the school for not punishing students harshly enough and issued a subpoena for internal records. Representative Virginia Fox, Republican of North Carolina, accused the university of having a, quote, waving the white flag in surrender while offering up a get-out-of-jail-free card, unquote, to student protesters. She further blamed, quote, radical students and faculty for interrupting the disciplinary process and called protesters anti-Semites. Fox then subpoenaed the university later in the week for records related to the protests, including communications among administrators in handling of the encampments, meeting minutes from the Board of Trustees, and documentation of alleged anti-Semitic incidents on campus. Well, the truth is the New York Times really didn't print this story. I'm not sure why. It certainly points out the strength of the Israel lobby in the U.S., and often the New York Times tries to avoid the appearance of the lobby being too powerful. But also, it may just be too pathetic, with another top university caving in to crude attacks by Republican lawmakers. But shouldn't readers be made aware of how freedom of speech is under attack on all U.S. campuses? But the New York Times has avoided this story and has avoided really an analysis of repression and the end of free speech on campuses all across the U.S. Our second story is from FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. And this actually is written by Jeff Cohen, taken from his Ralph Nader radio hour, in fact. Quote, I was a senior producer on Phil's short-lived MSNBC primetime show in 2002 and 2003. It was frustrating for us to have to deal with the men Phil called, quote, the suits, NBC and MSNBC executives who were intimidated by the Bush administration and resisted any efforts by NBC, MSNBC to practice journalism and ask tough questions of Washington before our young people were sent to Iraq to kill or be killed. Ultimately, Phil was fired because, as the leak's internal memo said, Donahue represented, quote, a difficult face, public face for NBC at a time of war. But the suits ruined our show when they took control and actually mandated a quota system favoring the right wing. If we had booked one guest who was anti-war, we needed to book two that were pro-war. If we had two guests on the left, we needed three on the right. When a producer suggested booking Michael Moore, known to oppose the pending Iraq war, she was told she would need to book three right-wingers for political balance. 3 weeks before the Iraq war started, and after some of the biggest anti-war mobilizations the world has ever seen, which in fact were barely covered on mainstream TV, the suits at MSNBC terminated our show. This quote by Jeff Cohen was hardly our mainstream media's take on Phil Donahue. In fact, the New York Times used its obituary to tell one more lie about Donahue's career, that he was fired for bad ratings. But internal memos have long ago pointed out why MSNBC let him go right before the Iraq invasion. General Electric, one of the owners of the station, stood to make huge profits from this war. Donahue was fired because he questioned all the war lies, and the New York Times can't get it right over 20 years later. Our third story is from Al Jazeera. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, has accused the Israeli government of, quote, buying ads on Google to block users from giving donations to the agency. UNRWA Commissioner Philip Lazuri said in a post on X that Israel's attempts to defame the agency both harm its reputation and put the lives of its staff at risk. Quote, these deliberate efforts to spread misinformation should stop and be investigated, This Lazzarini wrote on Saturday, calling for more regulations for companies, including social media platforms, to combat disinformation and hate speech. Israel has campaigned for years against UNRWA, the main organization delivering humanitarian aid to Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territory and providing services for Palestinian refugees in other countries since 1949, claiming it has connections with terrorists and lobbying for its closure. Well, this Israeli attack on a major relief effort for Palestine, all part of the genocide, and all kept out of the New York Times news coverage. Now, why wouldn't the New York Times report it when UNRWA accuses the Israeli government of buying ads and blocking users from giving donations? That's a story. That's a story left out of the New York Times. Quite consistently, if you look back at the New York Times, as we have on Activist Radio, the numerous times the New York Times have just left out some damning coverage. Well, but before we get to our song, which is coming right up, we have a point of view, class wars point of view, to dig into, and let's start that. We are so aware of the powerful Israel lobby and its money machine that we overlook the many ways that Jews have been used and abused by both England and the United States. Going all the way back to the Balfour Declaration, we find that England had a habit of promising Palestine to several nations and peoples at the same time. There was the promise made in 1915 to give Arabs independence from the Ottoman Empire. That was called the Hussein-McMahon Correspondence. And then there was a separate agreement with the French in 1916 that guaranteed Palestine would be under international control. And the rest split between two Western powers called the Sykes-Picot Agreement. England made all three agreements without ever consulting the indigenous inhabitants of the region. But how big a gift was this thrice-promised land of Palestine to the Jews? It was already owned and occupied by millions of Palestinian people. To make the area an all-Jewish state would take decades of ethnic cleansing and slaughter, something would eventually make Israel a pariah state in the rest of the world. A kinder, more reasonable solution would have been to let Jews immigrate to English-speaking countries where there is plenty of room. But of course, England and the U.S. did not want the millions of desperate Jewish refugees who needed a home. Giving Palestine to the Jews ensured that they wouldn't be clamoring to get into England and America. Probably the most important reason for the creation of Israel is the oil fields that surround our militarized colony in the Middle East. Not only did England and U.S. avoid huge influx of Jews, but these redirected immigrants would make up a military base to extend Western control over these vast oil fields. Israel would do the dirty work of empire without staining the reputation of English-speaking countries. It wasn't long before England and the U.S. began to see another benefit to the creation of the State of Israel. The Jewish Holocaust was a potent symbol and could be used in so many ways. Even the Western support of Israel's ethnic cleansing and genocide could be made virtuous by referring to the Holocaust. How could anyone dare criticize Israel, U.S. foreign policy, if it were done in the name of Jewish suffering? In addition, charges of anti-Semitism have become the weapon of choice in England and the U.S. for ending any criticism of the U.S. empire and its unholy alliance with Israel. If you are a college teacher who condemns Israel's war crimes and crimes against humanity, why, you must be an anti-Semite. If you're a student chanting Free Palestine, why, you must hate Jews. Our Congress is falling all over itself to make criticism of Israel illegal, and these laws are a particularly dangerous assault on our First Amendment, freedom of speech. But the use of the Holocaust and anti-Semitism for political gain cheapens and debases Jewish history and Jewish culture. Who will respect these terms when they're used to justify an ongoing genocide, who will be left to fight real anti-Semitism? Certainly not the 36 million Christian Zionists in America whose thinly veiled anti-Semitism should be a concern to us all. These supposed allies of Zionism are intent on pushing all Jews into the Holy Land where they can either convert to Christianity or be slaughtered. Only when Jews have been ethnically cleansed from the rest of the world will sweet Jesus appear and save all Christians from the carnage awaiting Jewish unbelievers. Is this final solution any better than the plan offered by the insane leaders of the Third Reich? In fact, is it really any difference? Will the creation of Israel prove to be the second catastrophe visited on Jewish people by Western imperialism? All right, we have our guest coming up, Robert Roth, co-founder of the Haiti Action Committee, part of the Central American Solidarity Movement in the 1980s and 1990s as well. And we talk about Haiti. But before we do the interview, let's go to our song, which is called Haiti Chéri, and sung by Harry Belafonte. So let's start with that.
Haiti Chéri, says Haiti is my beloved land. Oh, I never knew that I'd have to leave you to understand just how much I miss the gallant citadel, where days long ago brave men served this country well. Where sun is bright, or even with soft moonlight, a shading tree, Creole maiden for company, a gentle breeze, a warm caress if you please, work, laughter and play, yes we'll always be this way. Haiti Chéri, says Haiti is my beloved land. Oh, I never knew that I'd have to leave you to understand just how much I miss the gallant citadel, where days long ago brave men served this country well. Let me hear again the things that give music to my ear. The shepherd's horn that welcomes the rising morn, when roads overflow as crowds to iron market go. When the sun is bright, or evenings with soft moonlight, a shading tree, Creole maiden for company, a gentle breeze, a warm caress if you please, work, laughter and play, yes we'll always be this way.
Robert Roth, thank you so much for being on Activist Radio today.
Thank you for having me.
Whenever we look at any news coverage of Haiti,
it's always in rough shape, terrible shape. You know, gangs and violence. Was Haiti always like this? And what caused the problem that we see now in Haiti, which is violence, you know, lack of economic incentive? Where do all these problems come from? And is the U.S., does the U.S. have a role in some of these problems?
Well, absolutely it has a role, and it's had a role throughout Haiti's history. I mean, Haiti, the Haitian Revolution, where Haiti won its independence from France and ended slavery inside the country, and formed the first Black Republic in 1804, that sets the stage for centuries of U.S. attempts to crush the Haitian example. You know, at the beginning of Haiti's independence, the U.S. was, you know, firmly a slave-owning power, and it was determined to make sure that Haiti would suffer for freeing itself from slavery, and would not be a successful example to other enslaved people, both in the Caribbean and in the U.S. itself. And the Haitian Revolution inspired rebellions everywhere throughout the Caribbean and in the U.S. The Gabriel Prosser uprising in 1800, the Denmark Vesey's attempt to establish a free, independent republic in South Carolina in 1822, and the most famous of the enslaved rebellions in the U.S., the Nat Turner Rebellion, were all inspired by Haiti. And from the beginning, the U.S. imposed a strict embargo on Haiti. It supported the French, who in the 1820s forced the Haitian government to pay back France for freeing itself from slavery. So it's the only place where the enslaved had to give reparations to the slaveholders, and over the course of, you know, many, many years, that amounted to well over $21.7 billion. And, you know, with the first payment of that ransom, you know, which was enacted by French ships surrounding the port of Port-au-Prince with U.S. support, the first payment on that debt to France, Haiti had to close its public schools. And so,
amazing. You know,
yeah. And so Haitians will always say, we're not the poorest country in the hemisphere. We're a country that's rich in, you know, our population is rich in creativity, skill. You know, we work hard, but we have been made poor by imperialism. We've been made poor by empire and by the constant attacks on, you know, on Haitian sovereignty. And this has culminated, for example, in the recent period with the overthrow of the first democratically elected president of Haiti, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who was progressive, was building schools, was, you know, building housing for people, had raised taxes on the rich, had doubled the minimum wage, and as a result, the U.S. defined him as an enemy and overthrew him twice, once in 1991 and again in 2004. And the current crisis in Haiti is directly connected to the overthrow of the Aristide government in 2004. Mm. 20 years since, Haiti has descended into what Haitians call a hell on earth, you know. And, you know, if you read the New York Times or other mainstream publications, they call this, the situation in Haiti, a situation of gang warfare, which, you know, is one of the ways that they deny the responsibility of the U.S. in the situation, you know. And really, you know, these so-called gangs are really paramilitary forces connected to the governments that the U.S. has imposed on Haiti. Mm. And, you know, and that means that these armed groups have enjoyed impunity as they terrorize the population, you know, as they plunder communities, attacking poor communities all over Port-au-Prince and in the surrounding areas, and creating an impossible situation for people to live in. And that's directly, that is directly at the feet of the U.S. empire, which has created the conditions for this and is now trying to manage the situation that they've created. Right.
Now, lots of times or many times you see the U.S. empire invading other countries, and it usually can be traced back to, well, often oil or, our policy in the Middle East seems to be to overthrow governments until we control their oil. Does Haiti have natural resources, or why is the empire creating such misery? Because I can't really see the profit, you know, the profit from invading Iraq, and the profit would be oil. And but what does Haiti have that the U.S. wants?
Well, first of all, you know, if you look at places that the U.S. has invaded in the past, mm-hmm. you know, take Grenada, all right? Why did the U.S. under Reagan invade Grenada, a country of 100,000 people? Mm-hmm. You know, what they were trying to do was they were trying to get rid of a revolutionary progressive example, right. you know, in the Maurice Bishop government, you know, that was, you know, that was devoted to helping the poor in Grenada. Okay, now, you know, the Aristide government was similar. It was a bad example for the U.S. to deal with. In other words, an example of an administration that was determined to raise the living standard of the poor and to remove Haiti from the list of countries that were governed by these tiny elites, you know, in collusion with the U.S. Now, what does the U.S. want from Haiti? It wants its land. It wants its resources, which are very, very, Haiti has many mineral resources.
I see.
That the U.S. has craved. And one of the things that's happened in the last period of time is that under a series of U.S. imposed governments, Haiti has given up a lot of its land to U.S. corporations, especially mining corporations, U.S. and mm-hmm. Canadian corporations, who are digging up Haiti looking for gold, looking for bauxite, marble, all of these things that Haiti has. And, you know, at the same time, they look at Haiti as a cheap labor market, you know, both for, and so they've been constructing these free trade zones where garment workers, for example, you know, are paid, you know, less than $15 a day in these garments factories. And, you know, these have been created by the U.S. and other multinational corporations. And at the same time, in addition to the cheap labor market, Haiti has been flooded with U.S. goods. 90% of the rice that Haitians eat now comes from the West, you know, and Haiti used to be a rice producing, like a self-sufficient in rice production until the U.S. forced the Haitian government to lower tariffs on rice and flooded Haitian markets with what Haiti calls, with what Haitians call Miami rice. And at this point, Haiti is the third largest importer of U.S. rice in the world.
Amazing.
You know? So, you know, so these are, you know, a lot of times people just think of Haiti as, oh my goodness, it's a poor country. You know, like it's so poor and why would anyone be interested in it? Now, of course, there's a racist element to that, right? This is an African country. It's a black nation. And so all of these derogatory statements about it fly very well in the U.S., you know, and with the mainstream press, but it, you know, it doesn't tell the truth about the richness of Haiti, both in terms of its population and its resources. And they see
or,
it also,
or its potential, probably, right?
Or its potential, right?
Right.
Like, so for example, one of the things that the Aristide government did is it opened relations with Cuba. You know, it was the first time that he had diplomatic relations with Cuba. And under the Duvalier dictatorship, Haiti had been a bulwark against Cuba. So all of these things combine, you know, plus, of course, you know, historically, the existence of a free black republic in the midst of the Caribbean in the, you know, in the period where, you know, both of slavery and post-slavery, you know, racial terror in the U.S., you know, meant that, you know, the U.S. was always violently opposed to Haitian sovereignty. And the U.S. invaded Haiti, take over it from 1915 to 1934. That's 20 years. I don't think most people realize that, you know.
It's a it's an interesting it's
Haiti
such
is
an interesting
important.
History but
yeah what? Haiti is Sorry. Important
yeah
Haiti's very important to them, and you know they you can see it by the fact that they overthrew a progressive government twice, and they have enforced a foreign occupation of Haiti, you know, since 2004. Haiti has been an occupied country, and now they're reinforcing that occupation with foreign troops from Kenya.
Right. The it's funny that not actually not funny, but maybe instructive that sitting in Haiti and watching your elected president be overthrown twice. And watching all your natural resources being stolen and seeing the low wages that you're being paid, it doesn't seem like the U.S. has really changed its policy towards Haiti specifically, but towards Central America. Are we still doing the same things we did in the 1980s in Central America, trying to overthrow elected governments? Trying to steal, essentially, rob resources from these people? And has the U.S. not really changed its position very much?
I think that's accurate. You know, I mean, I think that, you know, I was in El Salvador three times during the what they called the Civil War, which was really a U.S. war against the Salvadoran people. And, you know, the death squads that were created in El Salvador as an adjunct to the Salvadoran military, you can look at these paramilitary groups in Haiti, and they're following the same script. You know, in Haiti right now, like over 5,000, you know, over 5,000 people have been killed in the last couple of years. 600,000 Haitians are now internal refugees fleeing from paramilitary violence. Half the country is facing what they, you know, is euphemistically called food insecurity. And so you have these conditions that are created, that have been created in the post-Aristide years. And if you look at Central America, you know, you see that the U.S. has had a big, big effect on, let's say, a country like El Salvador, where there was a vibrant revolutionary movement, and now they're, you know, under the control of a right-wing government that is, you know, that's completely connected with gang warfare, you know, drug trafficking, et cetera. So, yes, it's a similar playbook. Haiti calls itself the laboratory for, you know, U.S. imperial experiments, and that's happening as we speak.
The two major parties, you know, we're going through the conventions and the upcoming elections, and some of us are very disgusted that the parties don't seem to differ on Gaza at all, on the genocide in Gaza. Is there much difference between the two parties when it comes to Haiti? And maybe you could explain what Bill and Hillary was doing with Baby Doc. They have a pretty long history of involvement in Haiti themselves, right?
Right. Well, you know, they very famously went on what they called their honeymoon to Haiti during the Duvalier years and supposedly fell in love with the country. Both of them were instrumental during the Obama years in the U.S. project in Haiti. You know, if you read the recent news about Haiti, Michel Martelly, who was the president of Haiti from 2011 until 2016, has just been sanctioned by the U.S. State Department for drug running and for arming gangs. And Laurent Lamotte, who was his prime minister during part of that time, was also sanctioned by the Canadian government, this is just in the last year, for the same thing, particularly for, you know, creating, like doing money laundering to armed gangs. Now, it's interesting that they have sanctioned these leaders right now because it was the U.S. that imposed these leaders on Haiti. Hillary Clinton was in Egypt during the Arab Spring and came back to Haiti in 2010 to contest the results of the first round of presidential elections in Haiti because Michel Martelly, who was the U.S. candidate, was in third place, and Hillary Clinton met with the Haitian Electoral Council, and miraculously, after her meeting, Michel Martelly was in second place, eligible for a runoff.
I see.
So his presidency lies at the feet of the Clintons. At the same time, Laurent Lamotte, again, just recently sanctioned for trafficking in arms with these gangs and for helping set up these paramilitaries. Laurent Lamotte was Clinton's partner in the Clinton Foundation after the earthquake. He was the main Haitian partner. So if you really look at this, the government that the Clintons and the Obama administration imposed and that that has been continued to be supported until this day are the source of the drug trafficking and the gang activity in Haiti. It's right, it's their responsibility. And so even when they sanction these figures, and what are they doing? They're trying to clean up their act like 10 years later and present to the world an image that they're actually cracking down on all of this. But really, they have never said, in the meantime, they've never said, oh, by the way, we imposed these governments. These were our people. And, looked the other way for 10 years while the corruption and the drug trafficking and the violence escalated. You know, even while Haitians were pointing to it, Haitians as far back as the first year of the Martelly government in 2011 were saying he's a drug trafficker. And they had video of boats unloading drugs, with Martelly's people gathering up all of the containers, And so this has been known. And, if you look at the situation right now in Haiti, and I gave you all those statistics, it's a result of U.S. imperialism, and it's going to be a long battle to restore democratic and progressive government to Haiti. I don't want to lie about that. I don't want to just say, we're on the verge of, the resistance is so strong that it's on the verge of toppling all this. Not true. The resistance is there and it's growing. People are defending their own neighborhoods with whatever instruments they have. They're doing roadblocks to prevent these paramilitaries from coming in, and there are self-defense units all over Port-au-Prince, but these gangs are heavily armed. And you know, and where do the arms come from? They come from Miami. They come from Florida. You know, so it's a very, very difficult, very painful situation. The grassroots movement is mobilized to try to change this. And what the U.S. is doing right now with, you know, with sending 4,000, right now it's 400, it'll end up being about 2,500 Kenyan troops, is to ensure that whatever happens in Haiti in the next round, that it will maintain elite governance and that progressive democratic opposition will be crushed, you know, both by the Haitian police force and by foreign troops.
Well, with the two parties in the U.S., sort of imperialist parties, you know, who are all in favor of this, the destruction of Haiti and the robbery of Haiti, and I would throw in the media that doesn't really cover this, certainly doesn't cover the history we've talked about, does it?
No.
It never makes the connections there. As a matter of fact, it doesn't ever talk about Aristide, and such an interesting person who, against all odds, was voted in twice, you know, and both times deposed. So how do we change U.S. foreign policy in Central America? Is it education? Is it, you know, maybe having programs like this so people can say to themselves, this is not really what I thought was happening there. Maybe to get people involved in trying to change our foreign policy, or maybe pointing out the hypocrisy of U.S. foreign policy that talks about democracy and human rights on one hand, and on the other hand, support genocide.
Well, that's right. And, you know, the Democratic Convention should have, you know, I hope, it shook people up about the ways in which both these parties, you know, are supporting the genocide in Gaza. You know, Palestinian speakers were not even allowed to speak. There was not one Palestinian allowed to speak at the Democratic Convention.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. And, you know, and of course the press goes, well, you know, Kamala Harris said a few more things about the plight of Palestinians, but of course she did it in the passive voice, as if Palestinians are suffering versus Israel is bombing Gaza.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know?
No evil agent there, you know, that they're just suffering, but
just the suffering. And that's the same thing they do around Haiti. It's the people of Haiti are suffering. They don't have enough to eat. There's incredible violence in the country. You know, people are leaving Haiti en masse. There's internal refugees. But it's like, why is this happening? They don't talk about it. They don't talk about the role of the U.S. They don't talk about the role of the gangsters that have been running the country with the support of the U.S. And so it leaves people with this general vague notion of Haiti.
Of something being wrong.
Yeah, something is just, it's so horrible. And then you end up just saying, well, I really feel for the people of Haiti, without knowing that it is our job here in the U.S. to protest this, to be in the streets about it, to educate about it. And, you know, we've done, like in the Haiti Action Committee, we have supported the movement in solidarity with Palestine because we see that that's the pivotal
the links
issue,
are there.
Right? Yeah. And we want people to make those same links around Haiti, just like what's happening in Africa right now. You know, we want people to see those links and understand that we need a movement that unites those struggles, not that just keeps everyone in their own little silo.
And convincing people to step out of the Republican-Democrat parties as if they were offering any resolution here or any democracy either. But I want to thank you, Robert, for being on.
Let me just give people some websites to look for, all right? So
yes,
if you want to go to the Haiti Action Committee website, it's www.haitisolidarity.net. And we also have a Facebook page. And so if you look up Haiti Action Committee Facebook, you can find that. And one of the things that we do as well is we've been raising funds for the grassroots movement in Haiti. There's so many people who have been burned out of their homes, like activists, progressives, you know, activists in these communities. And one of the ways that we are trying to support them and also other projects in Haiti is through the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund, and that's www.haitiemergencyrelief.org. And every cent that we collect goes straight to Haiti. We have no paid staff. We're not an NGO. We're not, like, you know, we're not raising money for ourselves. And so those are some of the ways to keep in touch with us and, you know, keep abreast of the news and also to really, you know, support the grassroots movement.
Yeah. And so, I'll put those links down so people can follow up. And they'll have questions. And again, Robert, thank you so much for being on Activist Radio.
And thank you for having me.
Okay. Bye now.
All right. Bye-bye.
Activist Radio can be heard Thursdays 5 to 6 p.m. on WVKR 91.3 FM at Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York. Sundays 4 to 5 p.m. on WIOF 104.1 FM in Woodstock, New York. And Sundays 5 to 6 p.m. from the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM. Past shows can be heard on ClassWars.org. Please like our Facebook page, read our ClassWars blog for commentary on today's interview. We'll be here next week at the same time to help you become part of the resistance.